welcome to the Social Engineer Podcast, The Doctor Is In series. This is episode 265. I'm Chris Hadnagy, CEO and founder of Social Engineer LLC, the Innocent Lives Foundation, and the Institute for Social Engineering. And I've been hosting the SE Podcast since way back in 2009. Since this is The Doctor Is In series, we need our resident doc. So here you are. Nice to have you, Dr. Abby.
Good to be here, Chris. I'm Dr. Abby Morono. I'm the Director of Education at Social Engineer and a behavioral scientist.
Excellent. Man, you shortened that up now, didn't you? Because we kept messing it up anyway.
So I kept saying the wrong thing. So, I mean, I can keep going.
No.
That's basically me.
So here are a few quick announcements as Social Engineer is a sponsor of this episode. As usual, we have a couple really exciting things going on for this month. So this is coming out July 1st, July 9th. Abby's first book is going to be published. So if you have not yet done the pre-order, go do it now and it will be coming out and you're going to really like it. You're going to really enjoy it. You can get a little snippet on her TED Talk if you want to go check that out. We'll put a link in the show notes. You'll kind of get an idea of what will be in the book in the 11 minutes that she spent up on the TEDx stage. Also, if you really want to learn some awesome things from Dr. Abby and myself and the one and only Joe Navarro, then the only Joe Navarro U.S. event for 2024 is HubyCon. That's a human behavior conference here in Orlando at the Rice Pavilion in Rollins College, October 30. It is only $249 to attend. And we're going to be discussing a whole day workshop where you're going to learn how to be a master communicator using elicitation, persuasion, influence, nonverbals, and how you're going to be able to tie that all together to really solidify your communication skills. So really excited about that. And you can go to humanbehaviorcon.com and check that out. And we've been getting a lot of really great reviews on the elicitation course that Abby and I did together. So it's the art of information elicitation. You can find that on social-engineer.com. It's an audio only course. So you don't have to worry about coming anywhere, flying anywhere. And we've been getting a lot of great feedback on that. So your feedback is helping us to improve and plan our next course. So go check out those sites and you'll enjoy it. If you like the topic of social engineering, then you should be in our Slack channel. We have over 1500 people in there every day talking about all aspects of SE. We have people been doing it for decades and people are brand new and some are just enthusiasts and want to learn. So if you're looking for a family-friendly legal place to discuss social engineering and all aspects of it, come on in to the channel there. I want to take a moment to invite everyone who's listening to go check out innocentlivesfoundation.org. A couple exciting things. We have a gala coming up. It's going to be at the Woodshed, which is the action figures band. They're all made up of celebrities who have action figures, and actually they're really good musicians. And we're going to be at their studio on September 21 to have our second annual ILF gala. If you want to join us there and party out with us supporting our mission of saving children from child abuse and the threats of child abuse material, then you can come out there. You can support us through sponsorship. But go out to the website, check it out, check out the other information that we have there. And you'll be able to see some of the things that we're doing. And if you like the music on the show, it is none other than Clutch. So go to clutchmerch.com, check them out, get a t-shirt, go see them live, and give them a thumbs up and a big like and a thanks and a hug because Neil helped me start the ILF back 6.5 years ago. And last but not least, if you like the content, continue giving us hearts, thumbs up, likes, whatever it is that you do on the platform you're in, and your comments. Your comments are really helpful. I mean, if you come back and you say, I really want to know more about this topic, or you have a topic idea, throw it out there. Dr. Abby and I really look forward to that. We answer every comment that comes in. So please feel free to put them up there on the YouTube channel. Okay, Dr. Abby, what are we discussing today as our theme?
So our theme today is psychological myth. We see a lot of those posts that say psychology says, and then the post will claim something that psychology absolutely does not say. But given how some of these misunderstandings and myths have been popularized, it can be hard to know what's true and what's not. So I thought it'd be a fun session today to be Mythbusters.
So wait, hang on. We got to clear this up because you're telling me that where I get all of my scientific knowledge, which is TikTok,
yeah,
because the guy's wearing a white lab coat.
Yeah.
And he says that he knows science.
Yeah.
That's not real?
I know. And people say it so confidently too, especially on TikTok. And if they put psychology in their name, how am I supposed to know? So no, to clarify, TikTok, even blogs and YouTube are not reliable sources of information, typically. It's mostly who is giving the information.
But wait, I know what what we can trust. What about if their YouTube channel has got millions of views? Then it has to be real, right?
So how we look for reliable information is the validity of one, the source.
Okay.
And the source is either the person providing it or, say, whether it's a research paper. If we're looking at reading it, the most accurate source of information are research papers. But not everybody enjoys reading research papers. So look at the blog. No, most people don't. I do, but most people don't.
Yeah.
So I understand. Yeah. Well, I understand going to a blog, but look who wrote the blog. Because the real factor that I look for is who is providing the information. If the information is about science, is the person a scientist and is it their field of expertise? If not, then they're probably not the most reliable source of that information and you can find more reliable. Do they have credentials in that field? Are they a practitioner reporting on practice? Now, the reason I say that scientists should give a more accurate source of information of science is because they're very uniquely qualified to understand research. You can be an advocate of science and read a lot of it, but you don't have the unique understanding as a scientist who have trained for 10 years to interpret that kind of research. So if you are looking for the most reliable sources of information, compare what information is being given out to the person giving it out.
But let's say I'm a layperson. I'm listening to this podcast. I'll admit it. I do not enjoy reading scientific papers unless there's a purpose behind it, like I'm doing some research or whatever. And I want to verify that this video, this YouTube video, this TikTok video, I don't really want to spend 3 hours researching to verify my 60-second video is valid. Like, no one's going to do that. So is there a way that we can instruct people to kind of, you know, just not believe everything they hear? Or how can they verify more quickly?
It's a tough one. I wish I could give a really easy answer and solve misinformation. But typically in psychology, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. Usually experts, you can tell an expert versus a non-expert by how much they draw on the simplification. So no scientist or behavioral scientist will ever say it's this simple and give you a really complicated concept and say this always works. There's always a caveat with human behavior. So if you hear someone say 100% of the time this works, they're wrong. They're completely wrong. There's absolutely nothing in psychology that works 100% of the time. Anybody that claims anything of that realm is not a scientist and is not an accurate sender of information. So if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And look at the credentials of the person given that information. So when I want information about interrogation, I might look at people who do research in that field, or I might look at practitioners who have a really strong background in interrogation, who have certifications, because they're not scientists, but they have certifications that are relevant so they can talk within that, because within that certification training, they're likely to have learned a lot of the science, or at least what applies to that field. So the credentials, whether it's formal or practical of the person, but just to caveat, lots of views on YouTube, subscribers are not credentials.
You know what I like about that one about practitioners is sometimes when you read something in science and then you hear a practitioner talking about actively doing it, you're like, it kind of backs that up. Like, you're like, oh, I read this in a scientific paper, but then he's saying or she's saying that she uses that exact method and it really works. And that's kind of, sets it in motion for me. Like, okay, I'm getting both sides of it now.
You know, that's what I have really enjoyed with our relationship with Brad Beeler from the Secret Service.
Yeah.
We have started doing teachings together where we teach the science and he talks about the practical applications of that in interrogations. And it's really nice to see from him to seeing what's going on inside the brain and the body to make these things work. And then for us to see it in practice working is really, really exciting.
Yeah, that is true. That's 100%. Okay, so let's get into it. What are some of these myths that maybe people have heard and that we should discuss? Because there's probably quite a few, and maybe we won't get to be able to discuss every single myth, but let's discuss some of the big ones.
Well, let's start with the one that I get most often. When people see that I have a PhD in psychology, or people typically think I'm a psychologist. I'm not. I'm a behavioral scientist. Big difference. But whenever people hear psychology, first thing they ask is, so can you read my mind then? You would be surprised how many people genuinely think that psychology gives you a direct path into their thoughts. When people ask me what I do and I say behavior analysis, the first thing is, come on then, tell me what I'm thinking. The way I love to explain it is psychology gives you an insight into human thinking, but not to human thoughts.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm laughing because, you know, I get the same dang thing when it comes to social engineering. Like, as soon as someone hears your social engineering, I don't even want to talk to you because you're probably manipulating me right now. It's not like you walk around just, like, you know, analyzing every statement from every person all the time. I mean, that would be so mentally exhausting.
Yeah, but I can promise I don't think I've been on a date ever where I've said that I'm a behavior analyst and they haven't said, so tell me what my body language is doing. Go on, then just tell me. Oh, just a quick analysis.
Yeah.
No.
The answer to that, no. Sorry. We're not playing this game.
We're not in class.
Yeah, it happens all the time. Like, if I'm on a call with someone and they're like, oh, like a client, or like, you're not SEing me, are you? I'm like, no, like, we're just having a chat here.
SE means social engineering.
Yes, sorry.
Yes,
yeah.
Just to clarify.
you know, shorten it down a little. Okay, so how about this one? This one I hear all the time.
Well, no.
We only use 10% of our brains. That's true, right?
This is one of the most pervasive myths in psychology.
Yeah.
And I hear this all the time. In reality, we don't use 10% of our brain. We use all of our brain. And we know that we use virtually all parts of our brain most of the time. And brain imaging technology has shown that even for simple tasks, multiple brain areas are active. And we know advances in neuroimaging technologies over the past, 15 years have shown that the vast majority of the brain is active even during those simple tasks. Even when the brain is at rest, it still exhibits substantial background activity and energy consumption. So that 10%, more than 10% is being used even when the brain is at rest.
So is it a capacity thing that people got confused at? Like our brain has so much more capacity than we're actually utilizing, and the messaging got confused and then misrepresented a million times?
So I don't quite know where this came from. I think a lot of it comes from wishful thinking that we can unlock brain power. But if you think about it too, the messaging with these influence publications and influence teachers is unlock brain power, unlock unused brain power. And it's not really unused brain power. It's just that we're not always the most productive with how we think. We kind of get in our own way. We don't always unlock one's cognitive capacity or cognitive ability, but it doesn't mean brain power. It means maybe we're not overcoming obstacles, we're being unproductive, or we're getting distracted. That doesn't mean that we're only using 10% of our brain. It's that we're focusing our energy on the wrong things. And then films like Limitless, where they take a tablet and then unlock the rest of their brain power, doesn't help. And it's a nice, reassuring thought that there's brain power there that we can get to. But research on brain damage studies have shown that damage to even a small area leads to significant loss of function. And that wouldn't be the case if 90% of the brain was redundant or inactive. So from all of these studies and the fact that our brain weighs 2% of our body mass, right? But it takes up 20% of our energy consumption. That's a lot. That if it's such a small organ, that's a huge amount of energy. What is it doing? If we're only using 10% of it. So no, sadly, we use more than 10%. Well, most of us, some. Questionable.
Okay. Give me another one. Give me another popular one.
Okay. This one, I am stunned that people still believe. And I thought very much that people knew this not to be true, but I saw a recent post on LinkedIn about this and people following and promoting and really getting defensive. So I thought this has to be in here. People are either left-brained or right-brained. So this myth likely originated from early neuroscience research in the 1960s, particularly the work of Roger Sperry, and he studied patients with epilepsy who had undergone surgery. We do have a right and a left hemisphere. And then the division is, there's a structure that connects the two hemispheres called the corpus callosum. His work demonstrated that they have somewhat different functions. And say language ability is located in the left, for example. However, these findings are very much oversimplified. And then in popular media, it suggests that each hemisphere operates almost independently from one another. And we also didn't have the neuroimaging technology back then that we do now to understand, well, that's not the case. And then we have books and media that, again, have popularized this notion.
So I heard this one before, but I'm confused about, like, what do you think the motive for saying that I'm left or right brained is? Like, is it that one side is more logical and one side's more artistic or something like that?
Yes. So, okay, we have from modern neuroimaging studies, we can see that both hemispheres are involved in nearly all cognitive tasks. But some people do use some more in a significant way than others. And the two hemispheres are highly interconnected, but they serve slightly different functions. So, for example, when we do spatial reasoning tasks, we see higher activity in the right hemisphere. When we do tasks like language, left hemisphere. So those parts of the brain are separated in kind of the type of work that they do. We have creative work that is a little bit more one side than the other, but they complement each other. So what we have done is we've taken this notion of, okay, well, this part of the brain is more active for these kinds of tasks. So this is the part of the brain that I use. It's not quite that simple. We know that even when the activation is heavier on one side, both sides are actively involved. And we know from studies, again, on brain damage patients or a split brain patient where that corpus callosum has been split, when they have undergone that surgery or have damage, their brain function is still integrated. They are able to kind of compensate for the functions lost on one side. So say one side is heavier in cognitive tasks. If I now have damage to that region, the other side is going to compensate for it and pick up on activation that it otherwise wouldn't. So it's not that we don't, it's that they share activity and it's heavier on one side. So I understand why this myth prevails, because it is heavier activation on either side, but it's just been largely oversimplified. And you cannot be trained to be a one side of the brain user versus the other, be more creative, activate this side of it. It just, it's not that simple.
Okay, how about this one? Psychology says that venting anger reduces it.
Okay. So funnily enough about this one, prior to this, I was speaking with one of our team. I have had a particularly rough couple of weeks and I really want to use a rage room. And it's where you just go into a room and you get up and you just beat stuff up.
Yeah.
You just have a bat and you just smash things. And one of my friends said, oh, that will really help you with your anger right now. And I said, well, it won't, but I still want to do it. So venting anger does not reduce anger. The idea that expressing anger, like hitting a pillow or punching a punching bag, say after a breakup, lots of people will say, put their face on a punching bag and punch it, you'll feel better. And it's known as catharsis theory. But what actually happens is venting anger increases anger. And this has roots in early psychoanalytic theory. So most anyone that's familiar with catharsis will know that it stemmed largely from Sigmund Freud. And Freud believed that repressed emotions and impulses, they build up in a person and it leads to psychological symptoms. So he theorized that expressing those repressed feelings could provide relief and mental health. But now we have, you know, stricter regulations on psychological studies. Freud doesn't just sit in his bathtub anymore and go, had a thought. And everybody goes, wonderful thought. That's absolutely correct. Now we know from psychological research that when we do act on those venting impulses, it doesn't decrease anger. It amplifies anger.
So is venting, when you say venting, are you talking about like complaining about it? Or are you talking even punching the bag or something like that?
Physically venting.
Okay.
So talking about things is different. So when we talk about things, it helps us understand how we feel. Mm-hmm. However, there is a fine line too. When you talk about things too much, it can increase rumination and actually keep you in that cycle for longer. Yeah. But in general, talking about things and verbally venting is really helpful. But physically venting anger, and even when someone is verbally venting anger, it's good to get it out, but anger is usually a symptom. When you dig deep, anger is a secondary emotion. Usually there's something underneath it, say pain or sorrow or sadness or grief or something. So it's good when it's verbal to get underneath the anger, but physically it's not helpful to physically express it. However, I am still going to the rage room because sometimes it just feels good.
I wanted to make sure we clarified what we meant by venting, because I think in the right setting, especially like, let's say your therapist, venting your anger could be very helpful, right? But just not beating your therapist up, of course, or, you know, bringing her to a rage room or something, you know?
Yes.
Now, does this work for other emotions? Is it the same philosophy for other emotions? Like if you're venting the other, let's say disgust.
Well, it was really hard to physically vent other emotions. Like, how do I physically vent grief? Crying, but that's different because crying is really good for the nervous system. It increases endorphins. It activates parasympathetic nervous system. How do I physically express a surprise? Well, I scream and then it's gone. And so anger is really one of the only ones that we can physically express in that way. Like happiness, I mean, can you vent happiness? Because that's trying to make it go away. But I don't suggest trying to make your happiness go away. You know, so I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, but anger is the only one really that can be expressed in that way, because anger is the epitome of violence. So most violence stems from that anger.
Yeah, I remember Dr. Ekman used to say to me that anger was a gateway usually to violence.
Yes.
Like, you don't see people who are happy getting violent.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and anger and aggression are highly interlocked. And the broader implications of regularly choosing to vent anger can include the development of an aggressive personality. And it obviously, from that, leads to poor interpersonal relationships. And research comparing venting and other coping strategies like distraction and relaxation, and not distraction and avoidance, distraction, but also feeling and relaxation are very, very different. When you distract and use relaxation techniques, it's much more effective in reducing anger.
Okay, give me another one, Doc. What's another one?
Okay, so hypnosis can make you act against your will. This one makes me laugh so much because, there's two things here. One, does hypnosis work? And two, can it make you act against your will? In movies and sometimes on the news, I've seen some ridiculous things on the news. Hypnosis is depicted often as a control tool.
Yeah.
So bark like a dog. I watched one and he was like, when I click my fingers, you're going to take off your shoe. And they happened a couple of times. And once he clicked his fingers and I saw her register, I forgot to take off my shoe. So it was very manufactured and it was obviously very artificial. And it can lead to a lot of misunderstandings in the field. When it comes to hypnosis, and we'll explain in a minute, but hypnosis is, there is no argument that it works. It works. It has been undeniably, irrefutably proven to work as a suggestibility factor. It's used extremely well in therapy. And the reason it works and the misunderstanding is hypnosis doesn't put you in this state where you're completely unaware of everything and you're in this magical realm. It just alters consciousness. So if you think about waking to sleep, it's not a yes and a no. It's not binary. You have stages. That's how we have sleepwalking, sleep talking. So it's a spectrum. Hypnosis moves you across the state of consciousness spectrum. But can it make it act? We'll explain that a little bit more in a second. But can it make you act against your will? No. A person cannot be hypnotized against their will. If you don't believe that it will work, it likely won't work. It's like trying to give someone therapy that doesn't want therapy. It's not going to help them heal. If you are resistant to it and reluctant to use it, if you don't believe it will work, it will not work. And if you do think that it will work, can it make you act against your will? And can it make you go against your morals? No. If you are asked to do something against your moral compass, you will come out of the hypnotic state. Mm. So if we look at neuroimaging studies, because really it's about the brain, we're putting the brain into an altered state of consciousness. So we want to look at, okay, well, what's going on in the brain? What it does is it doesn't involve a surrendering of control. And that's where a lot of the misunderstandings come from, that people think that the hypnotist is taking away your control. That's not what happens. What happens is it's putting you in an altered state of consciousness and it's focusing your attention. Mm. So people under hypnosis show heightened activity in brain areas associated with concentration and processing of information. People think that it's the other way around, that they're not processing anything. It's the opposite. They're processing in a heightened state and an altered consciousness, but you're just navigating where you want them to process and where to focus the energy.
Because, you know, you see these videos, like, and they're, to me, they're so ridiculous. Like, you know, there's like 8 people on a stage, this guy's clicking his fingers and they're all falling asleep, but not falling asleep because they're not falling. Yeah. Their head's just down, but they're somehow perfectly able to. I mean, I've done this before. I've literally fallen asleep at my desk and my head hits my keyboard. I don't fall asleep and somehow stay perfectly posed, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I think about like, you know, we talk about some of the early psychological principles, like the stuff that Bandler and Grindler started, but then it turned into street magic.
Right? Yes.
And then it lost all of its essence of its purity, because what it became was this, I tap your shoulder and you think that, you know, this remote's a banana or something, you know, and it's like, it made it so whatever was there that was based in some kind of psychology was now just kind of thrown away because it seems so silly.
Yeah. Yeah, and people say, you know, that click my fingers or tap you on the hand. And that, again, is very misunderstood. Human behavior is also often triggered by triggers. So if you go to sleep and you play a certain film, well, likely that film when it's played is going to make you feel a little bit more tired because we have context-dependent states.
Sure.
And that's kind of what it's doing. So if you relate that state of consciousness and the sound of my voice and you use a trigger point, just like anything, it can help get you into that state. But it's not magic. I don't click my fingers and then instantly you're asleep. It doesn't work that way. When you actually look at people that do hypnotherapy, and hypnotherapy is extremely effective because of that altered state of consciousness. So if you have heightened fear, it can help you get through a situation while reducing those intensity of those emotions, but still go through processing what happened. And if you actually look at what happens in those therapies, there's a really, really long time that it takes for people to get into a state that they have the ability to be hypnotized. Mm. When you look at this state, it's a really focused state, like meditation. The same as meditation, you can't just sit down and you're in a mindfulness meditative state. It takes time to actually get into that state and for the brain to get into that state of consciousness. So media has really ruined it. And whenever I teach it, I try and teach it from the brain perspective because I understand, again, why a lot of people will dismiss hypnosis. But if we look in the brain, there are changes that, again, are irrefutable. We have a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex, and it's associated with decision-making and attention. This shows altered activity during hypnosis. And the changes suggest that enhanced focused attention, but also reduced peripheral awareness. And that's really key. It gets rid of all of those outside focuses. And that's when they say, just focus on the sound of my voice. And I want you to do this one thing for me. All of that other background stuff, it fades away. It's gone. My brain isn't worrying about that stuff. I'm just worrying about this one thing. And when someone is using their voice in this way, we do know that the way we use our voice can affect the nervous system of the listener. So we can put them physically into a calmer state using our voice and then using that suggestion. But again, they have to be willing. And it's also interesting because there is an increased communication between particular brain regions too. So what we can do is those outside distractions, we can get them to go away. And we want specific regions to communicate. They communicate much easier and much more nicely. So it has that increased suggestibility state. So there's a lot of science behind it, and it's been used really effectively to treat mental health conditions, including anxiety disorders, phobias, even PTSD. And it can be used as well to treat postpartum depression too, because it gets people in a state where they can start to explore what happened and how they're feeling without a lot of those emotions that can come in and be really overwhelming.
So kind of like EMDR.
Yeah, and again, that's one that has a lot of support to it, but it's really misunderstood because there is a lot of science to it, but also bad science and bad media representation to it.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to our final myth. What is our final myth, Doc?
This one could cause a lot of arguments in relationships because we all love to be right, and we all hate to think that what we remember is not true. But memory does not work like a video camera. So people think that, you know, their memory, what happened, I mean, other than people who have a photographic memory, it doesn't quite work as it sounds. But, you know, my sister has a photographic memory. She can look at something, she remembers it exactly, but she doesn't know it. And it's not quite like that with events. So the typical person does not have a memory that works like a video camera.
I cannot tell you how many times I have remembered a situation and the person with me remembers it completely differently. Like it's almost like we were in two different situations. And I'm like, but what the heck? This is what happened. And they're like, that's not what happened.
And it can be really uncomfortable because our memories really make up who we are.
Yeah.
So if I take away all of your memories, I take away you, because we are the accumulation of what we've been through, what we remember, our relationships. And some people say, no, that's not true. And my personality, but isn't your personality made up of really who you are and what you've been through? So saying you remember something really important to you, or you had an argument and you say, I know you said this thing. And the other person is saying, I didn't say this, you said this. Both of you are arguing, you could both be right in your own heads. One of you are lying because you both remember it, but one of you might be remembering it wrong, or one might be remembering it. Both might be remembering it wrong. Because memory is not a photograph, it's reconstructive, it doesn't reproduce reality. And what I mean by that is every time you remember something, the way that it works is I want to bring a memory. So I'm going to tell my neurons to pass on a signal to go get it and then bring it back to me. And then I'm going to tell it and I'm going to put it back. So I'm going to re-encode it. So each time I remember it, I'm bringing it back and I'm putting it back. What happens is factors surrounding that recall, they're going to change it. Because each time I recall it, I have to re-implant it. So it's going to get tweaked. Imagine I tell a really happy memory, but I'm angry when I'm talking about it. I'm sad when I'm talking about it. That emotional factor is going to get slightly intertwined with that memory. If I remember something bad, but I remember it more bad than it was, or worse than it was, well, now the memory itself is going to get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
So how we interpret events at the time that they occurred is not always quite how they were. And people can remember the exact same events differently. And the worst thing about this is most likely to happen with emotional charged memories. And those are the ones that we really want to remember accurately, because they're the ones that mean the most to us. But they're the ones that are most likely to be incorrect because they have such that high emotion attached to it. So we pull it out and it's that emotion that is going to start to get changed and intertwined.
So I also, like, I think about this part of the memory thing is because, like, I know I said this before on the podcast, but like I disassociate from childhood stuff. And then my siblings will tell me a memory that happened and I'll remember it now. I quote unquote remember it, but I know it's not actually mine. Like, and I know it came from somebody else telling me what happened. And then, you know, years later, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that situation, but I don't. Yeah. I just remember the recreation from my siblings telling me what happened.
Yeah. And the researcher that's the most influential in this field is obviously Elizabeth Loftus. Huge inspiration to me. She's amazing. But she did a lot of work in eyewitness testimony. And this is one of the reasons that we don't pay as much attention to eyewitness testimony as we used to, because it's very easy to alter memories or implant memories. For example, there was a study and they had people look at, say, a scene, I think it was a cafe, and there was a man in that scene. And then later on, they had a lineup of someone that, people suspected for a crime. And then they showed a, you know, a crime scene. People who had previously seen the man in the cafe clip were more likely to say, he is the suspect. He is the perpetrator.
Recognize
and
were them.
Quite certain on it. Yeah. And it's because the memory of the crime scene and the memory of the cafe got interlocked. And because we were familiar with the face, we said, it's because of this. And then once we say it once, we can re-implant it and we can strengthen it because we like to be strong on our beliefs. So once we've stood and said yes, we then convince ourselves it's correct and we can enhance the not reliability, but we can enhance how accurate we perceive it to be, not necessarily its accuracy. And we also forget too that human memory is subject to decay. And as time passes, memories fade, but they also become entangled with other experiences. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people will tell stories and they're kind of telling two different stories at the same time and they accidentally get interlocked. That's the nature of the human brain, because it's also a misunderstanding that when we think about a memory, we just shoot to one brain region and then pick it up. Memory is stored in various components. Mm-hmm. So when we're taking out a memory, we're, okay, well, here's the emotional factor. Here's the physiological emotion. Here's the affective component. Here's, you know, this component of it. And we bring it all together. So there's a lot that can happen and interfere with that each time we play it back.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Well, I liked at least covering some of these, and I liked giving advice on at least how, like even as a layperson, to make some verification. Because I think what's going to start happening more so now is the fact that you can produce videos so easily, and now we can produce videos with deep fakes and produce videos with AI technology. And when Sora comes out, you can actually make what looks like a realistic film and add any context you want to it.
Yeah.
It's going to make it harder to trust and verify things than ever before.
And I mean, I say this as a scientist, but question everything.
Yeah.
Question everything. Don't always believe what you read. And even if you are given information from a source that is very reliable, when it comes to psychology, it's okay not to believe it, because my supervisor at the time told me this. She said, if any paper published was 100% accurate, you would never have multiple papers published on the same thing. Because human behavior is subject to change and it's subject to subjectivity and interpretation, nothing is 100% certain. Change one thing in the study, maybe you don't even realize, maybe it's what we call noise. And it changes the outcome. So it's never 100%. And people have different theories. There's tons of different theories for the same factor. And none are necessarily wrong, because they're both very well evidenced or multiple very well evidenced. It's up to you to try and use common sense. Try and use accurate information as much as possible in terms of the research papers or the people giving you that information. But also come up to a judgment of, collect that all together and use your own initiative. What feels right to you?
Yeah. I think it's good advice, Doc. So hopefully everyone enjoyed this. I mean, we do a lot of these myth-busting
episodes. I love a myth-bust.
Yeah. It's good, I think, to kind of get the science straight out there. So what are we doing next month? What's our topic?
Okay. This is one that is probably going to hit a lot of people. And I actually changed it recently. We were going to do psychological mysteries to follow on from myths, but we're not. We are doing self-sabotage instead.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
I like it.
Something that a lot of people really, really suffer with. A lot of people are subtle self-sabotagers or really overt self-sabotagers. So this one might help you understand why.
Another therapy session. That will be great. And everyone who's listening, don't forget to go check out Abby's book. It's going to be out in just 9 days from now when you're listening to this episode. And hit humanbehaviorcon.com, and you can come and spend the whole day with Dr. Abby and I having discussions just like this, but in person and live.
And just for people listening, the title of the book is
It's a good
Work
thing.
In Progress, The Road to Empowerment, The Journey Through Shame.
It might be good to mention the book we're telling them to buy.
Yes, go buy the book.
Yes, figure out which one it is. Actually, if you type in Abby Morono into Amazon, it does come up, but it is better to have the title. So, and we will put a link in the show notes to make it even easier for all of you. Thanks for joining us this month. And thank you, Doc, again for the wonderful session. And we'll see you next month. Till then, stay safe. See you.